Hello, you're very welcome to The Week That Really Was with John McGurk and Sarah Ryan. It's the 8th of June, 2023. This week, after the excitement of last week, where we were joined by the ever erudite and smart Mr. Cormac Lucy, it is just Sarah and myself. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Enjoying the fine weather. I went to Lambay Island on Saturday on a boat.
Is it true they have kangaroos or something out there?
Wallabies, they do. And I thought it was an urban legend. I really did. And I saw them. There's loads there. Apparently, so years and years ago, whoever lived on Lambay had two wallabies. And the wallabies would get sick or whatever. So he kind of would contact the zoo, and the zoo would say to him, oh, you know, give it cat food or whatever. And he developed this relationship with the zoo. And then the zoo was completely overpopulated with wallabies, and they were going to have to do a cull. And then somebody came up with the idea of giving a few wallabies to the guy who lived on Lambay. So they gave him seven males. And I don't know if they identified as something else, because now there's 2,000 on Lambay. So yeah,
That's a
that's
lot of
the story.
wallabies. What's going to happen when they decide they need to do a cull on Lambay?
I know, yeah. But it's absolutely fabulous. I went swimming in the sea. It was gorge. I really recommend it to anyone. So well kept, and so much history, and it's really fabulous.
Yeah, I've never been. I'll put it on the list.
Yeah, definitely do.
Lambay Island off the coast of Howth, isn't it? It's off like the Howth. You see it from Howth, can't you?
Yeah, you see it. I can't remember. Can you see it from Howth? You can definitely see it from Malahide. So it's about 20 minutes on the boat from Malahide. There's
Okay.
a organization called Fish and Trips, and they do a boat over, a tour, and then they cook barbecue on the pier, fish and stuff, and you can have a glass of wine. It's fab.
Well, the way the weather's been, I would probably have jumped off the boat, to be honest with you. It's just too hot. At the moment, at least it is down in Tipperary, sweltering.
Well, you think everything is too hot. You're not like me. I like to be kind of well done. Like, I don't think 40 degrees in Greece in August is that bad.
Yeah, well, I am well done at the moment. I got well done on my holidays, and now I'm kind of healing everywhere, which is, I'm not, it's a good job this podcast isn't on camera, put it that way. Anyway.
Did you not put sun cream on? That's very Donna.
No, well, you see, I thought I was acclimatized to the heat. I'm an idiot when it comes to the sun, basically.
Like one of those people. Yeah.
I don't go that often, or else I'd end up like one of those German gentlemen you see on holidays when you do go anywhere sunny with skin like a tortoise. From oversunning, that would be me. Anyway,
I'm the opposite. Like, I'm like good, you know, good at the sun cream most of the time, especially with the kids. I heard a dermatologist on the radio this week, and she was saying that like something shocking, like 30 or 40% of your sun exposure in your life is before you're 10. So I have sun cream all over them every day at the moment.
My mother used to do that. I hated it. They'll
forgive
you when you're
hate it. They hate it. I mean, and I said to Keith the other day, they hate it so much. I was like, and they've never been sunburned, so they don't have any, there's no fear. You know what I mean? There's nothing I can. So I was like, maybe they just need to experience a mild bit of sunburn to see how unpleasant it is, so that this won't be such an ordeal. But they go mental. They have to be held down. It's in my eyes. Oh. So yeah.
Yeah.
But we strolled her on. I'm not winning on many parenting things, but I'm winning on the sun cream at the moment.
Well, I have to ask you to start the show about your experience as a parent, because today in France, I just, every parent's worst nightmare sort of unfolded. Where somebody, a gentleman, I said on Twitter that I wasn't going to watch the video. And I fully intended when I tweeted that not to watch the video. And then somebody I work with pointed out that since I'm the editor of a news organization, we probably needed to publish at least some of the video. And so I had to watch the video to decide what bits of it couldn't reasonably be published on a family news website, because it's one of the most extraordinarily upsetting things I've ever seen. Just horrifying. Not actually, you know, if you do watch the full video, which I don't really recommend because I don't think anyone needs it in their life. There's no blood in it. There's no gore. That whoever was videoing instead of helping, which I don't like, but whoever was videoing instead of helping, was sufficiently far enough away that you don't see anyone getting wounded. You don't see anything horrible, but you hear screams, and the screams are worse. Screams are worse.
Yeah.
Than the image of what's ever happening, because they're primal screams. They're screams of a mother watching their child be attacked for in a playground, no warning, while the assailant runs around with a smile on his face. It's the most disturbing thing I have seen. And when I was younger, Sarah, I was stupid enough when I was younger to
You
watch
watched
stuff.
a decapitating video, didn't you?
Yeah, of course. I think
I think lots of people did. I never did, but I know people who did.
Yeah, this was worse.
Well, I'd say it is.
This was worse. It was less bloody, but it was worse.
I stayed off Twitter for the whole day because I find that, you know, the way things can just appear on your feed, and you're kind of 10 seconds in before you realize what it is. Yeah, like I have obviously three children, but, you know, I have a 1.5-year-old, which is roughly the age of at least one of those children, and I'd be in the park. So it's hard not to imagine or project your own circumstance onto that horror. I mean, it's just violence on a level that's not like, it's incomprehensible. Like, what's the point of that? I don't even, like, and it's not that one type of violence is better or worse than another, but in some ways it is. And like, if you're doing something, well, we don't really know if it's a terrorist attack yet or what exactly the motivation was, if any. Is it just a lunatic, you know what I mean, who just went on a killing spree or whatever?
No, it feels much more targeted. And I'll say what was interesting about the video was that, and I say interesting in a, it's not interesting, it's revolting, but it's the revealing is probably a better word than interesting, is that he didn't attack the mothers. Push them away, all right, but he didn't attack the mothers, didn't go at the mothers with a knife. Which tells me that this individual, the location was a playground, he targeted the children. The objective here was to kill kids or to severely wound kids, which feels to me like, I'm not a criminal psychologist, I don't work for the police, you know, like a lot of other people, I probably watch some amateur crime shows, so, but my opinion is not expert, but it felt like me that this was a deliberate attack on sort of the last taboo, the thing that even ISIS wouldn't do, you know, the thing that even,
well, they did bomb a children's concert a few years ago, didn't they?
Did they? No. Okay.
I remember Ariana Grande in Manchester. That was a kids' concert.
Yeah, but even for slightly older, they weren't toddlers at that. You know,
they weren't toddlers. Yeah.
Young people, and there was a sense there with the, there's kind of always, some of those people who do ISIS crimes are kind of very young, 18, 19-year-old, basically speaking in plain terms, blokes who can't get laid and decide that Western decadence is evil. You know, that's a lot of what goes on there. They don't attack kids like 3, 4. This felt like it was deliberate to me, like it was deliberate breaking of the glass, a shattering of the last kind of universal taboo that we're supposed to have in society in terms of, you know, I mean, I suppose American school shootings do it, but that's normally kids attacking kids, right? That's normally some student who has messed up. This is an adult grown man attacking toddlers. It felt to me like there was just like the world is just so messed up at the moment that this is somebody almost crying for attention in the most revolting possible.
And is he dead?
No.
So he's still alive.
The French police did capture him by shooting him. They shot him, but they shot him in the leg. He will presumably face French justice and spend the rest of his life in prison. Normally I'd say, there's been no trial yet, but I saw the video. This guy's guilty. So, you know, I don't mind prejudice.
Seems unlikely that he's getting off.
Well, unless he pleads some sort of insanity defense, in which case he'll spend the rest of his days in a mental hospital. But I, you know, for me, there should be the death penalty for this stuff. And I don't approve the death penalty. I think death penalty is bad policy in general, except in the most extreme cases where guilt cannot be disputed and the crime is so bad that there is no possible rehabilitation, and also where there's an element of vengeance that society needs to take. For me, from a primal point of view, this guy needs to die. He won't, but I think, as I say, I'm not a death penalty proponent, but I don't see how any other punishment is really sufficient.
Yeah, I think I'm a bit similar. I mean, I thought that he'd been shot and killed by the police and I wasn't upset about it. Oh, I don't know. It's just so horrifying. The whole thing is horrifying. Did you say he was smiling?
Smiling, laughing, cheering, singing. Apparently, This is the other element of the story, which is funny, is that I've seen some reports, and this is none of this is 100% verified. I've seen some reports that this guy is not, as you might suspect. You hear Syrian migrant to France, you think maybe Islamic terrorism. Some reports suggesting he's actually a Christian and that he was shouting something like "Praise Jesus Christ" as he was doing it, which would be a turnip for the books, not the usual kind of thing that you have happening in society, thankfully. But whatever the motive was, whatever the state of mind was, there was no obvious indication that there was any restraint or reluctance in what he was doing. He seemed very happy to be doing it.
Well, you just said it yourself. The world is just so messed up at the moment. It's scary. I don't even... there's certain things I just try not to think about too much. And this will be one of them. It's just so horrifying that unless it's right in front of you, it's best to try not to think about it.
I think that explains some of the reaction. You know, I think oftentimes you see... and I saw a good bit of it on social media today, that when something like this happens, people are almost eager to move the conversation on to the next bit. The immigration angle, if you're somebody who's concerned about immigration, because this person had just come to France in the last couple of weeks from Syria, so the French imported the killer of their own children. Legitimate debate to be had there. But then on the other side, Sky News ran a piece on Twitter about how the danger was that this person will be used to demonize immigrants and brew up the far right. And it strikes me that both reactions in their own way, I know this will demonize some, this will annoy some people who are usually my readers, but I'm just going to say it. There's almost an eagerness to move on to have a fight with normal people. You know, a fight with, you know, the left or the right or your enemies in the culture war, so we don't have to focus on what was actually done here. You know, that it's not really, you know, we don't want to talk about the guy who actually stuck a knife into a four-year-old because we'd rather talk about Nigel Farage or, you know, Paul
whose
Murphy
fault it is on some...
So,
I mean, I think that's... And that's because some things are so horrifying that no matter what side you're on, you don't really want to think about it too much. It's just beyond, you know, whatever. But, I mean, things... Like, multiple things can be true at the same time. Like... Lots of people come into France from Syria. They don't kill children, you know, or try to kill children. So it's not a, I don't think it's a smoking gun or a slam dunk or whatever for either side of any of those debates. I think it's just horrifying beyond belief. And that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I agree with you, it's not a smoking gun, but I would say you need to reflect on the fact the person did come from Syria. If he wasn't in the country, this wouldn't have happened. It might have happened to some poor Syrian kids, who knows, or wherever else he might be. But like, I was looking today, and I'm sorry to jump the conversation onto something we're going to talk about a little bit later on, but I was looking today at Ivana Bacic talking about how we might need a NPHET for refugee housing. And I was thinking back to the time when we had a NPHET, and Ivana Bacic, when we had a NPHET, and at the height of the COVID panic, which was a panic, made a speech on the floor of the Shannon. She hadn't won the Dublin Bay South by-election yet, but she was in the Shannon, and she said, and I'm not quoting her directly, but I'm quoting her accurately, she said, "How difficult is it when everyone comes into the country to lock them in mandatory quarantine and make sure we know where they go and that they're not leaving their hotel until we're absolutely sure they're safe?" That's what she said when it was about COVID. And if you said the same thing in the aftermath of this about people coming into your country, you'd be a racist, on Ivana's own terms. So yeah, I do think there is a debate to be had there, but it should probably wait for a week or two until the thing is calmed down.
Okay, but. So just on this, like, I don't think anybody will spit tea out with the news that I am Labour voter or supporter by any stretch of the imagination, and I don't want to be like too harsh, but like Ivana Bacic being leader of the Labour Party and the Labour Party in general from recent polling is at existential crisis levels, right? So Ivana has to, I mean, it's just kind of like this cringe kind of thing now of trying to jump on, piggyback onto any sort of issue with some hot take that a few people sitting around in a room somewhere have come up with. So it's like Neffet style approach. We will build, what was it, 1 million homes a year or whatever that was a while ago. It's like they have to kind of try and be hip and cool and like jump on every issue. And it's failing miserably. And the whole, I don't even know, I couldn't even come up with an idea for how the Labour Party would make themselves relevant anymore. But it's like, you know, word bingo or something. And they threw a load of words into a machine and it said, what are the hottest words from the last 3 years? And Neffet came out and they just tried to marry that up with the refugee housing issue. And just that was the new approach. Like, I think Labour are in big, big, big trouble. And I think that this kind of nonsense that they keep spewing out is them trying desperately, desperately to get anybody's attention. It's like somebody standing in the window of a, you know, brothel and slowly taking off one item of clothing, but, you know, at a time and hoping that someone will eventually notice. But it turns out that you're bollock naked and no one still gives a shit. Like, that's basically where we're at.
Well, that would be very depressing.
That's what it feels like. It's just like, how do we make people look at us and no one cares?
You're onto something about the coming up with stuff from the last years and throwing stuff year and so last few years and throwing stuff at the wall, though, because last week it wasn't Labour, but I think this is a thing that you're seeing a lot across sort of the Irish left in general. Last week somebody tried to make the refugees welcome t-shirts happen. You know, Maya Dunphy appeared on social media with one, Refugees Welcome, a couple of other celebs, and it just died to death. And that struck me that, like, there was a meeting somewhere in some room in Dublin 2 where they were sitting around going, no idea is too stupid. You just hit us with something. And somebody said...
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Somebody said, what about the repeal t-shirts? They worked. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. There's a TV show in America. It's like Saturday Night, or not Saturday Night Live, but like one of them, Jimmy Kimmel, I think. And he does this game with celebrities, right? Where there's like spinning, like a thing in a casino, those spinning,
a wheel
thing, but a wheel kind of, but there's two wheels beside each other and one wheel has names of loads of different type of singers and then one wheel has songs, so it'll land and it'll be like sing in the style of Cher, sing, or in the style of Christina Aguilera, sing The Wheels on the Bus, and it'll be like the, you know, and you have to like as a joke, yeah, whatever. So it reminds me of that because it's like item, t-shirts, style, repeal, issue, refugees, blah, 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 refugees welcome t-shirts, yes, that's it. Or in the you know, in the mechanisms, Neffet in refugee style, yeah, perfect, yeah, yeah. No, let's go with that. It's completely absurd. It is the classic symptom of, and it's not just government, it's also opposition, they're all exhausted, they're all bored, honestly. I think they're just tired and they're like letting like kind of 23-year-old people in a room somewhere come up with decisions because they're just like, oh, I don't even care anymore. It's just exhausting.
Yeah, what'll we do? What did, you know, some character called something Roy try on Succession last week? You know, that's where we're at. You know, it's
spin the wheel and let's get, you know, whatever going. Like, I don't know. It's the same with RTE TV shows. Like, you know what I mean? Celebrity Schindler's List on Ice or something. You know what I mean? Who even knows what they'll come up with next? Nonsense. Complete nonsense. And that's what this is. A Neffet style approach to refugee housing. What does that even mean?
Well, that's what I want to know, because I mean, does it mean bring back Dr. Tony? Like, is he gonna come back and start like giving out with people on the streets again and tell us all to stay at home and to, like, you know, open up a second room in our house for refugees?
Or is it someone who's going to come on the news every day and give numbers?
Oh, like, the numbers. Yeah, that'd be good.
Oh, yeah. So 37 refugees arrived today. One was housed. What? Like, I mean, also the numbers were a terrible idea during COVID.
What
Like
I think
people
is,
became consumed with them.
what I think of it is interesting about it as well, just from a sort of a meta level, is the idea that the ideal in Irish politics when there's a crisis is for the politicians to get out of the way and hand it over to the civil service. Because if you
Yeah.
remember, how Neffet came to the kind of prominence it did, it's because when COVID arrived in Ireland, we didn't have a government. We had a kind of caretaker Fine Gael arrangement because the election happened in January of 2020 and nobody had the seats to do anything, basically. And then Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael had to spend a couple of months talking themselves into, in Fianna Fáil's case, breaking their solemn promise not to win with Fine Gael, and in Fine Gael's case, talking themselves into a rotating Taoiseach and trying to
Good
figure out
times.
if they could
Good
do that.
times.
Yeah. And so we didn't really have a government. And so Tony Holohan kind of took the ship of state in his hands. And I mean, I think one of the books that was written about this, either the one by Hugh O'Connell or the one by Richard Chambers, looking at the reaction, basically, I mean, there were several admiring voices in those books going, oh, it was a glorious time. We had no politicians. Tony Holohan just led the ship. And it's funny to me that, like, I think a lot of people in politics kind of see that as an ideal era. You know, they didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
They could just stand by and say admiring things about Neffet.
But what I also love is that it's a perfect microcosm of like some of the and I include all of us Irish people as a collective, like that we, it reminds me of The Simpsons, you know, like when they used to be like rabble, 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 and they all like monorail, monorail. It's like Tony Holohan wasn't particularly popular when this kicked off. There'd been some, you know, minor problems with the cervical check, you know, like the things weren't great on that. And then all of a sudden it was like, well, COVID, and now it was like, let's all put pictures of Saint Tony up on our house and everything's wonderful and we've all just moved on to this and we just forget about everything else. All
Yes.
right,
Up
like
there.
you could literally do anything in Ireland, and then if you just like saved a puppy from drowning or something, it'd be fine.
I don't know. Well, some people, if they saved a puppy from drowning, still wouldn't get, you know. I mean, I'd say Peter Casey saved a puppy from drowning. He struggled to make the news. But I take the point that
that's fair. It depends on who you are, but yeah.
You're definitely onto something there.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I mean, if you're a right wing kind of like not part of the, you know, like not part of the mainstream media or whatever, you could literally rescue a flotilla of 1,000 people on it and no one would care. But yeah, but in this case, if you're in the right place at the right time, like same with Simon Harris. Simon Harris was not a particularly popular minister at all. Do you know what I mean? Like there'd been a no confidence vote in him.
He caused the election.
Like,
do you remember?
He caused the election, exactly. And then he became this interim minister for health and everyone thought he was goddamn wonderful again.
Minister for Justice, you mean? Or were you talking about before that?
No, I'm talking about... No, he was Minister for Health while the government was forming.
Oh,
was
you're
he
correct.
Not?
You're entirely correct. Sorry, my apologies.
God, I got a fright there. I was like, what? Did
yeah,
I
he
just
was,
miss?
No, no, no.
Did
he
I
didn't.
misremember the entire phase of my life?
He's been interim Minister for Justice for the last couple of months, so I got a little bit confused.
Oh, yeah,
You're entirely correct. Anyway, the Labour Party, apart from calling for a Neffet-style approach to housing this week, have also, in the form of their deputy leader, one Éadan O'Riordan, been calling the Leaving Cert... What was the quote? Was it cruel and heartless and callous and bad anyway? Doesn't like the Leaving Cert, wants to get rid of it. It's not good enough for our young people, was his take. It's just too tough on them. I mean, my attitude as an old fogey is, you know, I'm glad something's tough on them, but what was your take on that?
Well, it's nice to see he's making other interventions into the state exam since his last one was to ban To Kill a Mockingbird, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Listen, the Leaving Cert is a hard exam. It's not a particularly enjoyable exam. The media whip everybody in the country up into a frenzy about it every year. It's not a nice exam, but it's not the only route in life. Maybe if we all stopped building it up into this massive, massive thing. Like I did my Leaving Cert. I didn't get a particularly good Leaving Cert. I didn't get a particularly bad Leaving Cert. I did well in the things I liked because they're the only things I bothered with studying. And I hadn't got no idea what I wanted to do. And I did history and English and UCD because I didn't know what to do. And the thing is that, like, even if I'd wanted to be a doctor, you can ultimately find routes. You know, you can do postgraduate things now. You can do other things. Like, there's a route to everything if you really want it. And so what they should be suggesting to young people is that is that exact thing, that like it's not the end of the world if you don't get the lead insert you want. You can repeat the lead insert, or you can just find another route to whatever you want. But like, it's not a great system. But what's the alternative? Like, there's no other alternative. It's the fairest thing. It's you know, nobody can say that somebody's daddy got them into college or whatever. The CAO and the point system is, you know, it's not ideal, fine. Doesn't suit all types of intelligence, but it is what it is. And, you know, like, stop this charade every year. It's awful. It's terrible. It's just the worst thing of your life. It's too suggestive to kids.
Look, I know some people say Sarah and me agree too much on this show, but like, there's just not much I can disagree with there. I mean, I'm exactly like you. I didn't get a dud leaving cert. I got a decent leaving cert. I think I got 485, 490 points, I think. 485, I'm trying to remember, 485 it was. And then I did BESS in Trinity, which is a nothing course. It just because it was 485 points, it happened to be my first choice. It was 485 points, but it was my first choice because I didn't really want to know what I wanted to do. I just knew, because I was a bit of a dick, that I wanted to go to Trinity. So after Trinity, I went.
Oh, God, you're one of those.
One of those, wasn't I? And just after Trinity, I went, spent 4 years, learned a few things, but very little of it in lectures. And, you know, the thing about the Leaving Cert that gets me is the same people who tell people not to stress are the single greatest sources of stress. So you've got all these columns every year. Don't stress about the Leaving Cert. It's not that important. Then once the Leaving Cert started, it's like, let's review the English paper. Here are all the answers. Here's how the question should have been answered. And I can just imagine some poor neurotic kid at home reading obsessively and trying to convincing themselves that they messed it up when they didn't.
Yeah.
Or even if they did, you know, who cares? It's one of those exams where the people who shout at you don't get stressed. They're kind of like, you know, if you're on the Titanic and it's sinking and there's somebody running around at the top of their voice going, don't panic, causing everyone to panic. That's,
and also, like, it's cliche, but it's true. Like, 22 years or what? Yeah, 22 years since I did my Leaving Cert. Like, the real problems in your life will never be about the Leaving Cert. Do you know what I mean? Like, the things that bother you, the things that affect your life, they'll never be the Leaving Cert most of the time.
No, but I still do sometimes get the dream. It's not the Leaving Cert. It's not the Leaving Cert. It's not the Leaving Cert. I do sometimes still, I don't get very many recurring dreams, but I do have this one recurring one where I'm in the back of my maths class at Miss Garvey. God rest her. She died too young. No, she's a lovely woman, best teacher I ever had. But I used to never do my homework. Couldn't be asked. As I used to be there, like, trying to frantically do the homework down the back of the class before she reached me. And I do wonder, that's a recurring dream I have. Like, there's a kind of a stress that gets associated with education that kind of stick with you. So I'm back in her class fairly regularly, at least once a month, not having my homework done. Even though she was
fascinating. But like, what's the psychology there that you just revisit that stress?
I suppose it's a sense of being unprepared for something. If I was going to psychoanalyze myself, Sarah, I'd say it's something about that. I don't know.
I don't have any recurring dream, John, at all, except for a dream of falling. But that's not a dream. That's just a feeling.
A sensation.
I don't remember the Leaving Cert being particularly stressful, and I remember caring about it that much, being honest. So when there's this big huge thing, like, hype, and it's the worst thing ever and blah 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 blah, like, the worst exam you'll ever do in your life. I literally last year was doing a drafting exam for the King's Inn to become a barrister, and I went into labor in the exam. So I can definitively say having contractions and doing a drafting exam in the King's Inn was worse than the Leaving Cert.
Yeah, so suck it up, kids.
Yeah, get a grip.
All right, so that's the Labour Party's contribution to the week. They want to ban, they want to bring in NPHET, and they want to get rid of the Leaving Cert. Strange.
Also, like, just again, it's just another item of clothing being dropped on the ground. Look at us, please, for the love of God, look at us. Remember us, we were here. We're sorry we annoyed you so much after that general election years ago and didn't keep any of our promises, but we're still here and we matter, we promise.
Do you think she'll lose her seat, by the way, before we move on?
Yeah.
Because I think she will.
I know that constituency very well.
Listeners who don't know, Sarah's father represented that constituency for many years. And Sarah and I both, I shamefully didn't canvass for Sarah's father, canvass for Lucinda Creighton in it. But I know that constituency very, very well as well. And they really are not a loyal bunch. They always kick somebody out. And it's always somebody high profile.
I think it's a funny constituency. I think it's, you know, I always remember, I don't know if the borders have changed a number of times, but I always remember it used to be Dublin 2, 4, 6, 8 and a bit of 10. And it's like the span is, you know, the Whitefriar Street flats, but Aylesbury Road, Ranelagh, you know, like it's just such a spectrum of all type. The only thing it doesn't have is a kind of a rural, you know, element to it. You know, the way like some parts like Fingal, Malahide, where I live now, there's a huge rural element to that constituency.
I always remember Michael McDowell used to always clean up in Rathgar because that's where all the barristers live.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a tricky, funny, and Michael McDowell would have been like in, out. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I think that, look, it's anyone's guess. Again, it will always depend. Does the government go to the full term? What's the parameters? What's the issues that a general election kind of focuses on? Because that does define a lot of how seats go. But I think that Fine Gael will have won. I think that Sinn Féin, unfortunately, will hold on to that joker seat. I think that the Fianna Fáil will hold one and the Green will hold on. I think that people who voted for Ivana Bacic will have been disappointed with her performance as leader of the Labour Party.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think a lot of them were votes that were lent to her from people who voted Eamon Ryan at the last election as well.
Yeah.
And he wasn't on the ballot in the by-election.
Exactly. And I don't think that, I think that there, from what I grew up in that constituency and I'm still have a lot of friends there and would, like, for example, I'm going to a memorial football match thing in Tulk Park for a local friend of myself, my dad's, who died during COVID, and they're having a memorial football match for him, and that'd be a huge local thing. And so I know a lot of people who still live there, and I never hear anything about her. So I think she'd be in trouble. But things could change between now and the general election, let's be honest. But you know, she got elected, her campaign was good in that by-election. You know, the other candidates, from the exception of Fine Gael, I did like him. But I think the candidates from the other parties were fairly weak. I think her campaign was good, and I think it was a moment, and she captured the imagination. But I think she'll struggle in the general.
Well, we shall see. She might. The one thing she might have on her to help her in the general. I'm getting better at these transitions. Is the fact that the people in that constituency might start getting a little bit angsty about their mortgages, those who have them. Because we got the news today that the Eurozone has entered a technical recession. It shrunk by, I think, about 0.1% for the second consecutive quarter, which means we're now technically in a recession. But the European Central Bank says that it intends to keep pushing up interest rates. They've gone in the last year from 0% to about 3.75% today. So, Sarah, you're on tracker mortgage. I think you've said that before. If you haven't, we edit it out. There are a lot of people out there who are, and it's funny, it's not being talked about. That's what I find bananas. It's not really been talked about, the pressure that rising interest rates are putting on a lot of people, because there's so much focus on the homeless, and that's kind of understandable, and those looking to buy houses, and that's kind of understandable. But there are a lot of people in this country with houses who are suddenly finding that their mortgage payments every month are going up and up and up and up. And it's not going to ease off, because the ECB are going to keep pushing up rates until they get this inflation thing under control. Which it's starting to level out, but it ain't dropping really fast yet.
Well, the idea that it's gone up, I mean, pretty depressing. I mean, everything has gone up and that's fine. But if you have a mortgage, tracker mortgage like I do, like the increase in the mortgage payment is like eye-watering. to say the least. And the
and it's
last,
not
like,
it's not it's not optional. It's not like if fuel goes up, you can maybe drive your car less. You know, if it's grocery prices going up, well, you can, I don't know, change your supermarket, buy own brand, something you can do to. There are ways you can cut back with the mortgage.
Yeah.
There isn't really a way to cut back on it. It's a fixed.
Yeah.
Some people,
It's
of
a
course, just
block
don't.
of money that just comes out. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. If you're smart, there are some people who just don't pay it, and then end up getting debt written off by banks and stuff. If they're wealthier, end up going to court and losing everything if they're not. But most people, I think, who are sensible know that the mortgage is a non-negotiable thing. And it strikes me as well that the government are increasingly going to be in conflict with the ECB, because the ECB's policy, obviously, is to make people poorer, to bring down inflation, because if you make people poorer, they can't buy as much. That means there's less demand for goods. Theoretically, prices fall. That's the theory behind pushing up interest rates to combat inflation. But the government, for political reasons, wants to make people a little bit richer. They want to put more money into the economy. They'll give people not necessarily tax breaks, as we discussed last week, but they want to spend more money, push up social welfare payments, push up pensions. So it's funny to watch, like, the ECB and the government are in many ways are at each other's throats. They're pursuing contradictory policies. And the opposition will make that worse, because they're all going to run on the basis of doing something about the cost of living, which is just a fascinating state of affairs. But how do you think that this is all going to play out politically? Because I haven't been paying attention, but I haven't heard much focus yet on the whole sort of mortgage sector of the economy.
I think that this is just going to be one of those things that doesn't really seem like a problem until one day it is. And, like, you're absolutely right that there's a few really loud things at the moment. There's housing and refugee crisis and all of these things. And I think all of a sudden, because I just don't see how it could play out any other way with the increases, with the, like, numerical increases in the mortgage payments that I'm seeing. And I know there's lots of other people out there in the same boat, that won't suddenly start to increase defaulters. Like, I just don't see how that's not going to happen, especially if these numbers keep going up. And I think that what tends to happen is, you know, we're going into the summer, gets into silly season, things go quiet. And then around September, October, there'll be a budget and things will just kick off. And I think this will become an issue ultimately. And I think that people, one of the things that I think is going to become more and more of a red rag to a bull to a lot of people and be bad for the government and be bad politically, is the fact that we're supposedly awash with money and people are absolutely to the pin of their collar in terms of their day-to-day expenditure. So I think it was you and I or somebody who was talking before about, you know, what percentage of your income you're giving over to the government in 2009, 2010, 2011, in terms of tax and USC and everything else, when the government was supposedly bankrupt, versus what percentage of your income you're giving over now when the government is supposedly awash with money. And if there's not a major difference, why not?
Yeah, and I would
argue,
as well, I'd argue as well that most public services feel worse to most people than they were back then. You know, when I think back to 2008, before the crash, when Bertie was still at the helm, I don't necessarily remember a land of milk and honey, but we didn't have the massive waiting lists we do in the health service. You know, classroom overcrowding, for example, had mostly been eradicated. Genuinely, that's not spin. It mostly had been. Most class sizes were 28 kids or fewer. Now that's an increasing problem in large parts of the country. Most public services were the public service was not really an issue. In most of those elections, there was some talk about health reform or what have you. Now it feels like the public services are kind of on their death legs. The government's taking vast wads of money and piling it up in huge mountains of surpluses, and people are at the pin of their collar. You've spoken very eloquently on this show a couple of times in recent weeks about people who you know, and I know people like them as well, with a couple of kids, two incomes. If you looked at them from the outside, you would say these people are doing really well for themselves. And if you talk to them and they're being frank, they'd say, we're worried about money every day of the week. We're scraping to survive. I do think there's a huge potential problem there. And I think your timeline is good too, because sort of September is back to school season, where if you don't know it yet, Sarah, you soon will. Cost of school uniforms, books, bags. It's a really expensive time for families. And then not that long after that, sort of the Christmas pressure starts. So I think it could be a sort of winter of not much content for the government if this continues.
And, you know, exactly that. And there'll be a budget and there'll be a lot of talk publicly about, you know, surplus and how much money is being put away, this rainy day fund and that rainy day fund and this and that. And that's all very great and very prudent or whatever. But if you're living, which a lot of my friends and people that I know who, as you say, from the outside look like they're doing really well, and they're living on their disposable income is less than the dole, and they work full time and they've got multiple kids and they feel like they get nothing. It's going to be like a red rag to a bull. Rainy day fund, it's raining. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, it's raining.
And then you add in, I'm sorry to come back to immigration. I don't want to talk about immigration. It sounds like I'm an obsessive, but like just today, I've just remembered, you had my dog is growling tremendously beside me. I think he doesn't like it when I talk about immigration. So if you hear the dog barking, I don't know what he's barking at, but he's barking at something. But you come back to today's piece where the government is spending 1.5 million euro on a voluntary contribution / fine to the European Union for not housing migrants. And you just wonder, what are these people doing? I mean, politically, what are they doing? I mean, this is something they've voluntarily agreed to do. I mean, 1.5 million euro is not a lot of money, but if there's one lesson I've learned from politics over the years, it's actually the smaller amounts of money that get you in trouble. Because people understand how much money 1.5 million euro is, much more than they do what 1.5 billion euro is. And here you have the government, when people are at the pin of their collar, handing over money in a hands-up admission that we've taken too many people into the country and we can't take any more. But by the way, we're going to keep taking more in anyway because we're paying more fines. It just feels like they're living on a different planet to the average person.
Yeah. But that's people, you said it yourself. Well, just there, that the small amounts of money sometimes, you know, end up meaning more than the big, you know, like what was the amount of money that Bertie Ahern supposedly spent on makeup? Do you remember that? It was like 131 grand or something like that. And that was like a big, huge thing. And it's not about the amounts. It's not about the, you know, it's about the mood of the nation when that story lands. And if the mood is wrong at the moment that story lands, it can just be like a match to a petrol soaked pile of leaves. And that's, I think September, October, that will be the mood. The public mood will just be, there's been a lot of talk about the budget. There's been a lot of talk about this. There's been a lot of talk about that. And I'm poorer than ever, paying the same amount of money in, you know, contribution to a state that is now awash with money. And you're talking about rainy days and fines that you're paying because you don't, you know, you're not in compliance with your refugee commitments, and I'm about to lose my shit.
The ever present threat of the far right, which we have an RTE program about this week again. So I don't know. I think at the start of the program we were talking about the French situation. Either you or I said, I can't remember who said it, that it feels like the world is kind of a little bit upside down. And that's just a sense I get talking to so many people at the moment. I was talking to somebody down here in Tipperary this week, not a particularly political person at all. And the phrase they said was, there's neither head nor tail on the country. And they weren't talking about anything specific. The conversation wasn't about immigration. It wasn't about taxes. It was just a general sense that something's amiss, that everything seems to be going wrong, everything is not quite as it should be. And I think that sense is there for a growing number of people. I feel it in almost every conversation I have. Now, maybe that is, maybe, I mean, you have to counter your own biases. Maybe that is people who know what I do for a living and read what I write and are pandering to me when they say that. Maybe they think everything's great. But whatever the reasons they have for saying it, that is something that comes up in conversation over and over and over again.
But you know what I think? It comes up in conversation for me, with me as well. But another thing that I think, and I think that this will become maybe like from a or like as a social experiment or whatever. I think that it feels like it's, you know, as you said, Nate, like there's no head nor tail to it. Feels kind of rudderless. And one thing I don't think helps that is the rotating Taoiseach. I think it feels like in and out and in and out, it doesn't work. I think it feels like there's no leader. I forget who's the leader, and I'm politically tuned in, and I, you know, like obviously I always know who the Taoiseach is, don't get me wrong, but you can sometimes forget. Like sometimes I'll say I'll read something that says Micheál Martin Tánaiste, and I'm like, oh yeah, God, who, what is it? And I don't think that helps. I think it makes the country, it doesn't feel like there's a person in charge.
And it also feels like, because I remembered, well, we didn't talk about this before the show, but I want to talk about it before we end, because it's something I wanted to talk about and forgot that I wanted to talk about. And it ties into what you're saying, which is that the leadership that there is seems to come from only one wing of the government. And I'm referring to the plan announced or re-announced or reaffirmed or restated this week to get rid of 200,000 Irish cattle. Which just, I mean, I know you're a city gal, it was actually the conversation I was just referencing where somebody said there's neither head nor tail on the country was from somebody who is affected by that and quite upset by it and just thinks it's insanity. And I have no idea. I mean, that doesn't feel to me like a government policy. It doesn't feel to me, and I recognize, by the way, not being naive, I recognize that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are going along with it, but it feels like they're going along with it. It kind of feels like a thing that is happening that the two major parties of government don't really favor, would rather isn't happening, but kind of can't really do much about. So they're not really running the country at all. It's being run by a few small members of the Green Party who believe that killing cattle is the best way to save the planet. It's a proposition which I won't describe in terms which I think, because it's a family show. But I mean, all I will say about it is that between now and 2030, Brazil plans to more than double its cattle herd. So if you think you're saving the planet by getting rid of 200,000 Irish cattle, I mean, come on. But the specifics of that proposal, how it's kind of come about, how it is kind of, it's sort of drifted into reality with the backing of a small number of sort of NGOs and activists and favorable noises from some people in the media and absolutely no enthusiasm of any kind from the people who are supposed to be running the country, but who don't want to stop it either. It just kind of feels like stuff is happening without the government really thinking that much about it. Is that an unfair assessment, or do you think I'm
No, I think that's spot on.
um
Combined with a lack of consultation with anybody who actually has something, you know, like to contribute to that conversation. You know what I mean? Like someone is actually involved. No contribution from relevant stakeholders. Just a group of people, like, and we have this with multiple other issues. People who know better than you, telling you what you ought to be doing with your life.
And can I say, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you talk about the lack of leadership, because when I look at the government, I don't see a Taoiseach and a Tánaiste. I see the leader Fianna Fáil and the leader Fine Gael. I don't feel like there's somebody who is running the country. I mean, do you take any of our recent leaders? Enda Kenny was the leader Fine Gael, but he was also the Taoiseach. He was the man where the buck stopped. It was him. Whereas now, there's a Fianna Fáil policy, there's a Fine Gael policy. The Taoiseach isn't really the Taoiseach because he's effectively the co-Taoiseach with the other guy, who's not really the Tánaiste. He's effectively the co-Tánaiste. They've rotated the office, but it's not really clear where the power in the government lies. And
No,
therefore, the
there's a
country.
the like the whole thing was done, and I get why it was done, and that's fine. But I think in the future, political minded people or political students will talk and study about whether this worked as a concept, and I don't think it did, because ultimately, the feeling that we're describing that I wasn't able to put my finger on for a while, and it just kind of came to me this week, is that it never really feels like one person has their arms around this whole thing. It feels like it's two people, you know, we're being co-parented by a divorced mom and dad, and you know, they have their own agenda, both of them. Like there's no unity here. There's no one has their arms around it, and so the ship is kind of all over the place, and it just doesn't feel like it's got a direction, and that's not. I don't, I'm not saying that's the reason why the thing feels like it's got no top or tail, but it doesn't help at all. And I think that, you know, if we were going into a general election again and there was some sort of referendum situation where you were able to vote for the concept of a rotating Taoiseach again, I wouldn't. I don't think it works. I think the book should end with one person, the Taoiseach of the country.
Doesn't
not
help.
Who's in, who's out.
Doesn't help that neither of them are a particularly effective leader in their own right, it should be said.
Yeah, fine. But even if they were, then the period where the other one was the leader would show that this doesn't work as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, either way, it's just not working.
Well, it's an interesting concept. And you know what we might do is we might get somebody in to talk about it on a more lengthy basis. But we're kind of out of time, unfortunately, this week. But for the record, I think you hit the nail on the head there. So we'll leave it there, folks. If you have any feedback, as ever, send it in to us, tweet it to us, leave comments on TikTok. I am amazed at how popular this podcast has been on TikTok. But we don't obviously put the full thing on TikTok. Various clips of it up, but the engagement has been through the roof, which has been great and heartening because we're not just talking to ourselves, which is a relief. When you start doing one of these things, there's all the fear you're just talking to yourself. So we've been very happy with the feedback that we've had across all platforms, but please do keep sending it in. But Sarah, thanks as ever for joining me. And until next week, folks, that was yet another episode of The Week That Really Was. See you soon.